Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. BP CEO headed out this week. A judge blocks the heart of Arizona's immigration law. WikiLeaks on Afghanistan. And the president on the stump from The View to Detroit. President Obama talked race and education at the National Urban League. He quoted Nadrea Lattimore, a 10-year-old girl from Kentucky, in words he might have written himself.
We are not black, we're not white, biracial, Hispanic, Asian, or any other nationality. No, she wrote, we are the future.
Big, sobering leaks on the war in Afghanistan. Some cheered the insight. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, condemned the website WikiLeaks.
The truth is, they might already have on their hands the blood of some young soldier or that of an Afghan family.
And Arizona's immigration law took a hit in federal court. Governor Jan Brewer was defiant on the need to act.
They need to step up, the feds do, and do the job that they have the responsibility to do for the people of America and for the people of Arizona.
This hour On Point, a week in the news. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Joining me today from Phoenix, Arizona, is Jessica Yellen, national political correspondent for CNN. Jessica, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
And with us from Washington is Tom Gelton, NPR correspondent covering national security and intelligence. Welcome back to you as well, Tom.
Hi there, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jessica, and Tom.
All kinds of furor where you are this week, Jessica. Here's some pro-immigrant rights activist sound. Pleased with the ruling is Jennifer Allen of the Border Action Network in Tucson.
People are genuinely happy, relieved that there is a great pressure that's been lifted off of people's back.
But Arizona Governor Jan Brewer said this is just a bump in the road.
This is an injunction. They haven't heard really the merits of the bill. This is just an injunction, a temporary injunction.
Just an injunction. But Jessica Yellen, we're told it sort of took out the heart, at least for now, of what Arizona had planned to launch, what, last night?
It did take out the heart. The requirement that illegal immigrants, all immigrants, in fact, anybody who's Latino basically carry papers with them proving that they're either a citizen or a legal resident is no longer required for now. But nobody here feels that this is over. The tensions, the emotions are still very high. And it's just very raw. There were massive protests here yesterday. Very peaceful, but I personally saw 35 people peaceably get arrested just to object to what they see as the racism in this law. And on the other hand, you have Phoenix residents telling me the feds aren't doing their job here. We tried to step in and do their job for them, and now they sued us to stop us from even doing that. A lot of frustration.
What are you hearing from officials in Arizona on whether or not they think they're going to recover these chunks of the law that Judge Susan Bolton has said no to for now? Do they think they can still win here? Or, you know, she's already hinted at her legal arguments. Does it look like they're up against, they've got a losing hand?
The politics on this are so dug in and polarized that, yes, the people, Jan Brewer says she's emphatic and believes she'll win. In fact, I interviewed the man who sponsored this bill, wrote the law, and he said he wrote it to take it all the way to the Supreme Court. He expected these challenges, and he says he's done the head count, he's done the analysis, and he expects to win on a 5-4 decision and wants to see it upheld so it can be repeated in other states. Now, legal experts don't necessarily agree with that. They're not sure that it'll prevail, but the people who are advocates for it are quite convinced it will.
Tom Gelton, you're there in Washington. Can you feel the ripples? Does official Washington expect this to end up in its lap, in the Supreme Court's lap?
Well, there's no question about that, Tom. I think Jessica's right in that regard. I think everybody is assuming that this will go all the way to the Supreme Court. But, of course, here in Washington, everything is viewed through the prism of domestic politics and electioneering. And, you know, there are calculations being made on both the Republican and the Democratic side about what's the winning position on this. And it's hard to see, you know, from a strictly political point of view. On the one hand, you know, Latino voters are clearly upset about this, and Latino voters are a big block in U.S. elections. On the other hand, we've seen a lot of polls out there that show broad sympathy for the Arizona law, you know, among the electorate. So I think as we head into the fall election season, you know, politics are going to be one of the factors that determines the positions that people take on this issue.
Jack, we've got a conservative high court. If it goes all the way there, can you see the federal hand in controlling immigration being sort of slapped back by the Roberts Court?
I have no idea, but given their commitment to originalism and original intent and all and what the Constitution says and so on, it looks like that would be a high conceptual hurdle. What I'm struck with is how just since this law has passed, views have become more extreme on this. Rand Paul, when he won his primary, in April, he was criticized for having talked about repealing the 14th Amendment protection for children of immigrants, illegal immigrants, people without papers who were born here. He wanted to repeal that. Well, today I read that Lindsey Graham, of all people, has signed up for that idea, to repeal the 14th Amendment or to change it. And Lindsey Graham, just months ago, was considered to be one of the Republicans who would work for comprehensive immigration reform. He was thought to be on the side of, working that through. So the politics of this already, I think, have been pushing the Republicans further and further to the right.
It will grind its way through the court. In the meantime, Jessica Yellen, you're there in Phoenix. What's your sense on the street? As you say, peaceful demonstrations, pro and con yesterday, but a lot of arrests. The Maricopa County Sheriff saying he's going to push on out and do his thing anyway. Is there, how high is the tension there? Is it a social unrest risk, or not there, Jessica?
Well, the tension is high, but they're used to living with this. This has been going on here for so long that neither side is surprised that the fight is continuing. The one thing I would add is that there seems to be a very big divide between the politics of this in Washington, where both Democrats and Republicans are getting more dug in on their opposing sides, and what people are really saying. So if you look even at the polls here in Arizona and around the state, yes, Tom is 100% correct. There's enormous sympathy for this law and support. The majority of Americans in Arizona support this law. But the next question when you ask them, should there be a path to let people stay in this country legally if they pay their taxes, work, and don't commit a crime, an even greater majority say yes. So on the one hand, people want the laws enforced. They want the borders protected. On the other hand, they know there are 12 million people living here illegally who aren't just going to get kicked out in most people's views. And there needs to be some sort of reform in Washington. So the one thing almost everyone agrees on is that the politicians aren't doing their job. And there's incredible frustration on both sides that Washington is being too politically cowardly to act.
Speaking of crimes, or at least ethics, a big spotlight on New York Congressman Charlie Rangel this week. He's been in the House for a long, long time, been taking his licks lately. Now he's facing, a trial there, 13 allegations of ethics violations. Before the hearing, in the hallway, here was Charlie Rangel, the veteran, with this to say.
60 years ago, I survived a Chinese attack in North Korea. And as a result, I wrote a book that, having survived that I hadn't had a bad day since. Today, I have to reassess that statement.
Jack Meade, we talked with Charlie Rangel about that book where he said, after surviving the Korean War, he's never had a bad day since compared to that, and he's reassessing that right now. Big trouble for this longtime, very prominent Democrat, and right in the middle of election season it will be, Jack.
Yes, and it couldn't be worse news for his party. There seems to be something about being a chairman of that Ways and Means Committee that you just get right in the center of scandal. Dan Rostenkowski just a couple of decades ago, for example. But Mr. Rangel, for years has been, I think, one of the most charming people on Capitol Hill. You can't find anybody to say a bad word about him. The Republicans like him. And his bonhomie I think has given him a certain amount of protection until now. I mean, as you look at the specifications, and there, according to the Daily News, there are 243 specifications under these 13.
Meaning subcharges, in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As you look at this, you just see a picture of a man who, after 40 years, has simply grown to feel entitled and immune to any correction from his constituents. And in fact, he's leading very comfortably now in his district for re-election.
Tom Gelton, what do you see here in terms of the political kick of this? Is this going to be a hot issue in the fall? Is ethics headed up the issue list?
Well, it sure has that potential, Tom. And, you know, I was listening yesterday to Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, talk about this, and you could just hear the anguish in her voice. I mean, the Democrats, the leadership tried so hard to work out a deal with Congressman Rangel that would avoid this situation of him, of a public trial in the Ethics Committee in September, in the fall, just in the eve of the fall elections. They really, really wanted to avoid it. I think the anguish is, you know, as Jack said, it's sort of personal as well as political. I mean, people are really fond of Congressman Rangel, and they hate to see this happen, and they also hate for it to happen politically because, you know, in the aftermath of the financial crisis and all the scandals around Wall Street and tycoons, this is the last thing that the Democrats need right before a fall election. So I think you've got, on two levels, the personal and the political, a real sense of anguish on the part of the Democratic leadership.
A lot of interesting action on the oil front, the BP front. CEO Tony Hayward will be out in October, stepping down, a little bit banished to Russia, but also he's got millions in his pocket to go away with. He'll be replaced in October by Bob Dudley, an American who grew up in Mississippi, 75 miles from the Gulf. Here's Bob Dudley on CBS on Tuesday.
I grew up in Hattiesburg, and I also spent my summers in Biloxi and Gulfport. It's very, very personal to me, just as it is for thousands of people of BP who live or work around the Gulf Coast, woven into the fabric of the Gulf Coast. And one of my commitments, not only now until October when I take on that role, but the continuing commitment will be there to restore the Gulf Coast.
Going to restore the Gulf, going to do everything it takes. Tom Gelton, you've been looking at BP and the oil industry in general, and never mind the health of the Gulf. We'll look at that in particular. But how is the oil business changed by what we've just come through, Tom?
It's a very interesting question, Tom. I think it's changed more with respect to this country than the rest of the world. We clearly see, a higher consciousness as far as the risks of deep water drilling in this country, in U.S. waters,
and fear of getting raked over the coals like BP's just been.
But we have a moratorium. A six-month moratorium. We have an energy bill working its way through the Senate that could lift the liability limits on oil companies. The consequence of this is that U.S. oil companies at least look at, you know, these potential punishments, and they have second thoughts about whether they want to continue drilling in these waters, having to pay higher insurance rates, having to deal with tighter regulations, because they have options. Countries all over the world are charging full speed ahead with their offshore drilling operations. And, you know, one consequence of this might be a shift of drilling operations from U.S. waters to the waters off the coast of those countries that have laxer, you know, looser safety regulations.
That may have environmental implications. What does it mean for the U.S.? Does it cut off U.S. access to the oil or just move it elsewhere? It's a fungible commodity.
Oil is a fungible commodity. There's a global market. The only difference it makes for the United States is that it means that we have less energy independence. We become more dependent on foreign oil. You know, I think environmentalists would like to think that the lesson of this is that we should be investing a lot more in alternative energy, alternatives to oil. This should be the takeaway that we get from this disaster. But whether that will happen, I think, is, we look at what's happening with the energy bill, and it's hard to you know, see mm-hmm. much prospect of that kind of thinking.
We'll look at that. And then there's reporters flying now over the Gulf, looking down for all that streaky oil and saying, where did it go? People wondering what happened to all that oil. Here's Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal.
Where is this oil? You know, their low estimate says there's nearly 400,000 barrels of oil. Their high estimate says there's 1.4 million barrels of oil completely unaccounted for, meaning it's not burned, skimmed, not dispersed, not degraded. And we push them. We need a better answer to that question, understand what are we dealing with.
Jessica Yellen, I'm sure you're not hiding it in your back pocket in Phoenix, Arizona, but it is remarkable now to look down on those surface pictures and see much less of that oil on top than we saw before. There's been a lot of talk about subsurface big clouds of oil, but now this weird question, what happened to all that gushing oil we saw for weeks, Jessica?
Well, it would be the greatest gift, first of all, to the Obama administration and obviously everyone in the Gulf if it turns out that this is somehow not the disaster everyone assumes it will be. But I don't think there's anybody who believes that we're going to get a gift on this. There's just such little faith in government right now and in our institutions to solve problems. The grand assumption is we're just not understanding something much worse that must be happening.
And reports here that fishermen along the coast really skeptical about a declaration that it's gone away, worried about the long-term effects of those chemical dispersants and much more submerged oil. But that story rolls on. Let's get to our listeners. Nashville, Tennessee. Mark, you're on the air, Mark.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you see, Mark?
I'm calling about the immigration story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an attorney, and the standard for granting injunctions in federal court, if I'm not mistaken, is a substantial likelihood of success on the part of the party applying for the injunction. So what that basically means is the court expects the plaintiffs to win at trial. It's not just an injunction.
That means that Judge Susan Bolton expects the Justice Department to win in pushing against the Arizona law, you're saying?
That's correct.
So what about this possibility of it going to the Supreme Court and a conservative Roberts Court ruling against it?
I think, as one of your commentators said, they're going to have a high hurdle to get past their strict constructionist views. From a strict constructionist viewpoint, it's my understanding it's the federal government that deals with immigration, not the states.
And has been for a long time. That could be a big obstacle. But yes, Judge Bolton tipping her hand, as you say, Mark, about where she thinks this may be going. Let's get one more on immigration from Nashville. O.C., you're on the air, O.C.
Yes, could your panel, to talk more about what this Congress has done for as I think there are more legal immigrants being sent back, more so in this particular
administration
versus the other. And I think if people would speak more about what he's done or what this Congress has done versus the other and sort of peel back on the law that Arizona is putting forth and give it more time to marinate and see what happens in a couple of years, at least give President Obama an opportunity to at least put his stamp on what's going on.
Well, it's interesting. Oh, see, Arizona doesn't seem in the mood to lay off if they have a chance. But Jessica Yellen, it's true that the Obama administration has, rather quietly sometimes, been pushing back hard and deporting a lot of undocumented workers in this country.
Yeah, by the government's own count, about 10% higher than during the Bush administration's 2008 total. So they expect to deport about 400,000 people this year. They do point out that instead of just targeting businesses and doing ad hoc raids, they're actually deporting people who are convicted criminals or people who are known in the system. It's a different focus. But the Obama administration has stepped up some enforcement efforts, and we actually, despite all the stories here, There is less crime along the Arizona border and along the border than there were in prior years. It's just more well-known crime, and it's reached a boiling point, so people are taking action. But this administration has stepped up those enforcement efforts. The frustration is there's no path to guest worker programs or legalization that really seems to be working.
And it doesn't seem to have really changed the politics of this. Let's get to Jordan on I-95 in Florence, South Carolina. Jordan, you're on the air.
I just wanted to address I wanted to address immigration first. I think that that the SB 1070, the law in Arizona, most certainly should be pulled by the government. It's draconian, and I think it essentially parallels Jim Crow laws that we saw in the South. It addresses a group of people based on what they look like, and it also takes due process out of any immigration process with folks who would be in Arizona, and giving the rights or giving the power of determining immigration status with state government officials rather than federal government officials.
Hey, Jordan, I see you're also thinking about oil and energy. What do you see there?
Well, I'm from a coastal area. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. And just realizing the lack of accountability that has gone into this oil spill. We remember hearing the chant, drill, baby, drill, and we didn't think about what would happen if there was a spill back then. And now we see where our greed for oil and energy has gotten us. We see how ill-prepared these oil companies have been in this oil spill, and we see how long it's taken at least to get it capped, and now we see how arduous this process is going to be to clean it up, to clean up the oil spill in the Gulf. Both my parents, born and raised in Florida, my grandparents, born and raised in Florida, and I think it's tragic how we completely overlook the natural beauty of this country just to seek risky energy.
Sounds like you're not in the drill, baby, drill camp. But, Jack Beatty, you know, there was a lot of talk a month ago, 2 months ago, in the middle of that gushing, that this might change the American politics around energy. You know, might be a real watershed moment. Do you see that having happened, Jack? Look at the climate bill. It didn't happen.
There was a shift in public opinion, however. More people, I think a slight majority, said they didn't want the Obama program of expanding more offshore drilling to go forward. And that was a shift from 2008, when there was almost enthusiasm for expanding offshore drilling. So the public seems to have reacted in that dimension. It hasn't yet been felt in politics, and whether it will be, we'll just have to see. But you know, one of the features of the coming political year is that oil companies are going to be, and we already see evidence of this, putting money into ads against candidates and for other candidates without having to say that they that they're oil companies, that they sponsored the ad. And that's thanks to the Supreme Court and to a Republican filibuster in Congress. So they're going to try to influence public opinion in the other direction.
Citizens United was the case before the Supreme Court that said money could pour into campaigns, and the effort to force disclosure of that pushed back by a GOP filibuster this week. Here's Democrat Majority Leader Harry Reid trying to cast his fellow Democrats as the voice of the American people in that debate.
I believe the majority of the Senate believes, and the overwhelming majority of the American people believe, the Supreme Court made a mistake with their decision in Citizens United. We cannot reverse its decision, but we can make sure that those who spend millions of dollars telling us how to vote publicly stand by their efforts.
Jessica Yellen, and yet it didn't pass. You would have thought that Americans might have wanted to know who was pouring money into these campaigns. Where do you think the Republicans get the confidence to say, no, that's not the way to go here?
Well, there is so much money in this issue that the Republicans feel that it's coming more to them than to the Democrats. They're going to fight hard for it, and it's just obfuscation on this one. Plus, the Supreme Court upheld it. So they have the Supreme Court on their side, and the Obama team is going to make Citizens United itself a big part of the campaign message, not just this year, but if it doesn't get changed somehow in the next intervening years as part of their 2012 campaign, as part of this overall message that they want to sell that the Democrats and the Obama administration are with the people and the other side is with the special interests, and they'll point to Citizens United as one of their prime examples.
I want to get to WikiLeaks and the whole Afghan story. Word just in the last 24 hours, sadly, that the casualty toll for U.S. forces in Afghanistan, the highest in the 9 years of that war in July. And, of course, 90-some thousand reports there, secret reports leaked, 70-some thousand of them out already. Lots of turmoil about that in Washington and beyond this week. Here's Afghan President Hamid Karzai saying that in the wake of those leaked reports, he's worried about some of his own Afghan citizens.
Names of certain Afghans who have cooperated with the coalition NATO have been also revealed in these documents. This indeed is extremely irresponsible and shocking.
Irresponsible and shocking, Defense Secretary Robert Gates yesterday. The pushback finally came from the Pentagon, condemning the publication of those documents by WikiLeaks.
The battlefield consequences of the release of these documents are potentially severe and dangerous for our troops, our allies, and Afghan partners, and may well damage our relationships and reputation in that key part of the world.
Tom Gelton, we know that this government, maybe any government, stands in fear of this kind of revelation and the power of WikiLeaks or anybody else to just put that kind of documentation, secret documentation, out in public. What about the assertion of the defense secretary there that it has potentially severe and dangerous consequences for the troops and relations with other governments? Is that borne out?
I think it's harder to make the case that U.S. troops themselves personally are in greater danger as a result of this leak. You can make a much stronger case that Afghans, individual Afghans, might be endangered. You know, there have been dozens and dozens of instances in these documents where Afghans who have worked for the United States are identified by name, some of them quite prominent Afghans. And that, you know, in the context of Afghanistan, where reprisals for cooperating with the United States are pretty severe, that has to be a concern. Now, in some cases, those were, you know, the references were old. Who knows, you know, what will actually happen? As far as governments are concerned, I think this is an even bigger issue for the United States, because diplomacy in that part of the world is so delicate, and particularly at this very critical moment. The Obama administration is working very hard to keep things on an even keel with its Afghan partner and with Pakistan, and to have all these sort of private communications about what's going on behind the scenes, you know, with respect to Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's really coming at a bad time for the administration. So I think that the repercussions that it could have in their dealings with other governments that is actually the biggest concern here.
Jessica Yellen, there's the possibility of consequences for troops, for Afghan, cooperators. There's also the political picture back in Washington and in this country. How do you think these revelations sort of pushed public and political standing on this war, Jessica?
Well, it seems to be one of those where whatever you believe is affirmed by what you read in here. If you think that Afghanistan's gone awry, you see more and more evidence of it. If you think that the government just needs to hunker down and focus, this is just more proof that the press is against the war in their view, and that the government needs to be disciplined in ignoring all this pressure. It's also a wake-up call to the military establishment and to the administration that there's a whole other universe now with the blogosphere, and that they have to accept that a lot of these things are going to get out in the public a lot more often, and they're probably going to have to change their practices in some ways of how they document things and be more agile at responding to this. The big fear is what else is going to be discovered as people keep reading through all these documents.
We had a vote on Afghan war funding this week. We'll come back and look at that and much more. Jessica Yellen, please stand by in Phoenix. Tom Gelton in Washington. Jack Beatty, glad you're here. Listeners, you can join us. Does WikiLeaks have blood on its hands here, or truth that needs telling? This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Charlie Rangel's ethics problem was late-night comedy fodder. Here's Jay Leno.
Only in Congress can you work out a deal with the Ethics Committee. So how many Benjamins are going to take to make this ethics thing go away?
And how big is Chelsea Clinton's multi-million-dollar wedding in Rhinebeck, New York? Here's Hudson Valley News editor Jim Langan.
I think it's the biggest thing to happen since the Washington's army drove the British out down the street in the 1700s. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than this and never will, I don't think.
And Snooki and friends are back on MTV in Jersey Shore in Miami. She explained why she's made the switch to spray tanning.
I don't go tanning anymore because Obama put a 10% tax on tanning. And I feel like he did that intentionally for us.
Oh, boy. How does this stuff get into the news? Victoria in Marlborough, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Victoria.
Hi, Tom. Shame on this administration and the Pentagon with regard to pointing the finger at some young speck in the Army releasing information. Where are the firewalls and the encryption and the super hacks that we should have employed by this government to save us and to help us in these wars that should never have been?
But it's not really about hacking exactly, I guess, Victoria. I mean, he whistled along to Lady Gaga and put it on a CD. That's just
let
human
information out. But why is how can he even have access to it at that level? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, we hear the dismay
about this.
Jack,
how many 13- and 14-year-olds around the world have hacked into the Pentagon?
Well, of course, that could happen, but this isn't exactly hacking in a way. It's more interesting. Jack, I mean, here, and it's Bradley Manning, he's in big trouble now. He's facing a bunch of charges, but the allegation is that, he was part of an integral part of the system of the military, and he took it out, not by hacking, just by putting it on a CD.
Yes, and I think Secretary Gates spoke to that yesterday, didn't he, Tom, about forcing the information down, and maybe they're going to rethink that?
Yeah, this is an interesting aspect of this case. Secretary Gates said that this was a lesson of the first Gulf War, that they found that the more forward that they can push intelligence right down to the frontline fighters, that they basically become better fighters, the more that they know about the situation they're in. But the downside of that is that the more you decentralize intelligence, the more you push it forward to the front lines, the more people have access to it, and the more people at low levels have access to it. And that's how PFC Manning was able to get access to this information. What Secretary Gates said, as Jack just mentioned, is that now going forward, they're going to have to weigh the benefits of decentralizing the intelligence, pushing it to more people, versus the risk of the security breaches that might result from that.
And so there we are up against this. I mean, war funding was on the table this week, and it got through, but it was a tough fight. Here's a little bit from that. Tuesday, the House approved a bill to provide $59 billion in additional war funding and international aid in Afghanistan. Here's Congressman Howard Buck McKeon, Republican from California, speaking in favor of the bill.
Our brave military men and women and their civilian counterparts are in the midst of a tough fight that's critical to the U.S. national security. Cutting off their funding in the middle of that fight is tantamount to abandonment. I'm confident General Petraeus and our troops will succeed in Afghanistan if given the time, space, and resources they need to complete their mission.
Confident they'll succeed? Of course, a lot are not these days. We've heard those voices right here in the last week. And in Congress, big questions as well. Here's Congressman Jim McGovern arguing that the money would be better spent on domestic projects.
We're told that we can't afford to help states keep cops on the beat or teachers in the classroom. We're told we can't afford to help more families send their kids to college. But we're asked to borrow another $33 billion for nation building in Afghanistan.
Jessica Yellen, did you hear a change in the tenor of the debate over funding itself this week in Washington?
Well, the fact that it actually got through without a huge fight and without the progressives really going after Obama is a sigh of relief for the Obama administration. This was one of those things I thought could get very, very sticky. And it's going. Nancy Pelosi has already threatened a bigger fight next year. This will be a problem for the administration as they go forward in terms of their politics, because the left is so angry about this and so resistant, and the Obama administration simply can't afford to not get the funding they need and not push ahead on the war front. So expect this to be a bigger, huge issue as the 2012 election approaches.
And yet the tension continues to rise. I mean, how does this get resolved, Jack, do you think, within the Democratic Party there?
Well, 32 Democrats opposed this funding last year, 102 this year, plus 12 Republicans. So that's a pretty dramatic shift. On the other hand, if you look at the polls, only 7% of voters rate Afghanistan as our top problem, as opposed to 38% jobs in the economy. So there doesn't seem to be any political risk one way or the other on this issue. What I've noticed is the shift in elite opinion. We had Richard Haass on the show, Council of Foreign Relations president, who was very strongly against the commitment there, wanted to scale it way back, very cogent reasons.
Now he is. I mean, he was in the George W. Bush administration.
That's right. Well, you know, his predecessor, or one of them at the Council on Foreign Relations, Leslie Gelb, said that he had to come out for the Iraq War because, quote, unless you come out for use of force, you're not taken seriously in the foreign policy community. Well, now it would seem you're not taken seriously unless you are against Afghanistan. The former ambassador to Afghanistan has come out with a plan to partition the country, north and south, to sort of quarantine the Pashtun south. And the vocabulary among elites has changed. Ambassador Galbraith on the air the other day used the word immoral. It's immoral to ask troops to fight in a losing cause like this. A writer in the Financial Times used the same word. So there's this shift in elite opinion. And in the rank and file of the Democratic Party, but it hasn't yet reached a public opinion. And when the president redid his policy and went through all his planning last year, he said, I don't want the issue of public opinion to come up. We're going to just talk about this in its own terms. And that seemed noble to Jonathan Alter, one of his biographers, because he didn't want politics entering in. On the other hand, it might have been cynical. He might have recognized that in the age of a volunteer army, people simply accept that these wars go on, that the soldiers are killed, and it doesn't reach a level of salience where it becomes a dominant issue.
Tom Gelton, the president certainly strapped himself to the Afghanistan effort in the campaign. Is there a scenario in which he unwinds that support? Is there a path?
The path would be that he has scheduled a major review of his Afghanistan policy to be carried out in December. And, of course, next July is the, according to the timetable that he prepared, that he laid out, would be the beginning of a U.S. withdrawal. Now, the definition of withdrawal, you know, has been left open. General Petraeus, the commander in Afghanistan, and others have emphasized that, in their view, it should be conditions-based. In other words, the speed of that withdrawal should depend on what conditions are there. But to the extent that President Obama has an exit ready, it would be, through the combination of this review in December and the timetable for next summer. I think that the problem for him would be that, he may not want to go against the advice or the counsel of his commanders. So far, he's been very reluctant to challenge the analysis and the recommendations of either Secretary Gates, his defense secretary, or his ground commanders. It may come to the point where he will feel compelled to challenge those viewpoints.
The president getting into a new venue this week on The View, no less, sort of morning popular TV viewing there. Talked with Barbara Walters and the rest of the gang, talking about everything from his vacation in Maine to his place in history. He's sitting back a little bit. Here's Walters, then the president.
What would you like your legacy to be?
I'd like the American people to be able to look back and say, this was a time when we tackled a bunch of problems that we'd been putting off for too long. Healthcare, we'd been putting off too long and finally got solved. Education, we're finally making the schools better for our kids. We need an energy policy so that we're not dependent on foreign oil.
Right.
And we're dealing with the challenges to our environment. And as I said before, I'm so optimistic about America because I'm optimistic about the American people.
And everybody's for optimism, and may he achieve that legacy. But Jessica Yellen, the economic news this week, not friendly toward that optimistic view. Not right now. Economic growth down in the second quarter, foreclosures up over last year. Just a feeling, Jessica, of it not taking off.
And it's enormously, it's first of all, an enormous tragedy for the people that I go out here and cover and report and meet, and enormously frustrating for folks inside the White House who feel that they have done huge sweeping legislation, arguably more in the time they've been in office than some presidents do in 8 years, and they're not getting credit for it because of the economy. But the bottom line is, you know, where is the real help for people who are facing foreclosure, for example? You bring that up. The Treasury Department's program to help modify mortgages, I started reporting on this a year ago. It's not working. That's the simple truth. It's just not working. And it needs stronger teeth. Congress needs to pass measures to force banks into changing policies on foreclosures or force homeowners to accept foreclosures. There's just such unwillingness to act on the big issues on this that people are really getting squeezed and hurt. But I'm surprised we're talking about The View and we're not talking about Snooki.
Yeah, Snooki. Okay. No, I mean, he asked her. They asked him about Snooki. He said he didn't know. Of course, he talked about her in his Correspondents Club dinner, National Press Club, the Gridiron dinner there. But you're in Phoenix, Jessica, and I'm just interested there. I mean, the foreclosures have been super high in Phoenix for a long time. The news this week is that the problem has gone beyond now. Some of that southern Florida, Las Vegas, Phoenix problem. It's hitting other metropolitan areas. Can you still feel it when you go down the street in Phoenix?
Oh, well, here, let me you really feel it because you also have immigrants fleeing. I mean, I was driven through a neighborhood, and I couldn't verify this myself. I don't live here, so I haven't been here a month ago, but a woman was driving me around and saying, these houses were full a month ago, and I'll tell you, you know, every third house is now empty in these blocks where you see Spanish, you know, language stores and a huge supermarket in this one community was shuttered, I was told, in the last few weeks. And so the entire community is also being depressed by that. Add in the foreclosure crisis, and real estate here is really taking a big hit. And there's not a lot of help on the horizon, and people are feeling it on the ground.
Tom Gelton, is there more help coming from Washington, or what do you hear this week as these tough numbers come out?
Yeah, you know, it depends on whether you see the deficit and as the biggest problem or unemployment. I mean, look at the big fight there was here a couple of weeks ago over the extension of unemployment benefits. You know, politicians, members of Congress have to make decisions about what their constituents care more about, efforts to rein in federal spending or efforts to, you know, do more for unemployed people. It's my sense that jobs is the big issue here. And you mentioned it before. Jack mentioned how jobs is a bigger issue in the view of American people than the war in Afghanistan. And one of the things that came out of these foreclosure numbers is that there is a rising correlation between foreclosures and unemployment. I mean, we're not just seeing foreclosures in those areas of the country where we had a huge bubble in the real estate market, like Las Vegas and South Florida. Now, the latest development is that there is a pattern here of foreclosures being worse in areas where unemployment is worse. And so these, you know, the economic problems are seeping over into the housing market now.
I want to look at another issue that came back into the news this week, really wasn't finished after last week, around Shirley Sherrod, the Agriculture Department employee who was fired for out-of-context remarks that got picked up from an NAACP speech. On Thursday this week, she came out and said she is planning to sue Andrew Breitbart. He's got his biggovernment.com that had that edited video of the speech up, sparking the firing. Here's Shirley Sherrod.
He had to know that he was targeting me. Now, whether he was also trying to target the NAACP, he had to know that he was targeting me. And at this point, you know, he hasn't apologized. I don't want it at this point. And he'll definitely hear from me.
He'll hear from me, says Shirley Sherrod. Jessica Yellen, we might have thought that by now it's going on 2 weeks, this might have floated away. No, it's going back the other way.
It seemed for a while that someone was holding her hostage inside a TV studio and making her do an interview with every working reporter.
Yes.
I mean, and now she's but, you know, the woman, I'm sure, is in a personal crisis. This must be overwhelming, and there's a lot of anger. And he kept saying, you know, John King interviewed Breitbart, and he kept saying, this isn't about Shirley Sherrod. This isn't about her. And clearly that was so insensitive and insane because it affected her more than anyone else. I think more than, you know, as much as anything else, this is a story about how people have to consider reading blogs and how different the, you know, loathed mainstream media is from bloggers, and that we do make an effort to try to vet our material, put it in context, and explain it before we put it up. And very often, as in this case, they don't. And if she's going to try to expose that somehow with a lawsuit, good for her.
Jack Beatty, have you got a bottom line yet on this whole saga of Shirley Sherrod and the blogosphere?
I was disappointed in the remarks of the president, I think, on The View. I just saw them quoted, so I haven't seen it. I saw it in print. But he seemed to be blaming the whole thing on the news cycle. There's this rapid news cycle. Things get on the air, and the mainstream media picks it up, even if it's only in a little, you know, hole and corner blog, and soon it's all over the... Well, he was really missing the catalytic role played by his own administration and very likely his own White House in bringing this about. As I understand it, this only became major news on all the other, non-Fox mm-hmm. world, when the White House, when the Agriculture Department fired Mr. Sherrod.
Yeah.
The president doesn't quite seem to get that his own administration was as responsible for the elevation of this as the, quote, news cycle.
Well, lots of incoming there at the White House from WikiLeaks and from blogs. You've got to have a sturdy hand right there, tested in the last couple of weeks. That's all we've got time for today. Grateful to each of you, Jessica Yellen in Phoenix with CNN. It's always great to have you. Thanks for joining us, Jessica.
Thank you.
Tom Gelton with NPR. Thanks so much, Tom.
Good to be with you, Tom and Jack and Jessica.
So long, Jack. Thanks so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.